Greg, that was wonderful. Thank you very, very much for sharing that with us. I came to know you first as reading all of your wonderful foreign editor work in the Australian. And one of the ways we've spruced this talk is to say, do you want to know what's happening in Myanmar? Ask Greg. Do you want to know who's going to win the US election? Ask Greg. Do you want to know whether Brexit's a good thing or a bad thing? Ask Greg. And this is a mission-minded church, so we have a lot of people in Asia and other parts of the world, so it may be, but I'm going to leave that to the audience when we get to audience time as to whether people want to ask you about specific foreign affairs type issues. But the second one I got to know was reading Is God Good For You? But this one, When We Were Young and Foolish, which is Greg's book about his life, effectively, a memoir of my misguided youth with Tony Abbott, Bob Carr, Malcolm Turnbull, Kevin Rudd, and other reprobates. And that's not on sale outside, but I'm sure Greg won't be the least bit upset if you go and buy it. And it's a really good read. It's got some great anecdotes in there. But it does prompt me to ask the first question, which is, as I read through this book, your biography, you started out life as in a working class home in Sydney. Parents didn't have a lot of money, but worked really hard. Catholics. You grew up in a Catholic household and a Catholic community, and then you moved on through life, university, and you're thinking about seminary. You went to a seminary for a while, I think. Is that correct? Yeah, and then you chose to move on from that life and into the university, into student politics. I think you were a union organiser for a while. You got an early job at the Bulletin, working with Trevor Kennedy, and I think Bob Carr was a journalist there as well. So that's how you got to rub shoulders with Bob Carr and ran into Tony Abbott and various other people at the time. And then on through that into your stellar journalistic career, culminating where you well, maybe not culminating, where you currently are at the Australian as the foreign editor. So I'm just thinking about, I'd like to ask you about your faith journey over that time, if I may. So, you know, there was obviously a time in seminary when you were feeling the call of God to that, or you were discerning the call of God in that regard, and then many other. And you're a very talented man with a great mind and a voracious set of interests in all sorts of things. And you've got university, you've got politics, you've got union organising, journalism. So much out there in the world, many things to distract. Could you just sort of map for us the trajectory of your faith journey from that young man in the seminary through to your days as a journalist now? And then, if you can, sort of what were the things that... I think you said there was a point in recent years where you've decided to come out of the closet as a Christian. What sort of led you to coming out of the closet, by which I take it you mean starting to become bold and much more patently, obviously, a Christian?
Mark, thanks very much for that. God bless you for having read that book. I tell you... That book was selling. It was quite dishonest cover because Tony Abbott, Malcolm Turnbull, Kevin Rudd, and Bob Carr don't come into the book until about 200 pages through. But, you know, publishers aren't that keen to publish journalists' memoirs, so I had to smuggle it in, you know. And that, in a sense, was putting my toe in the water for the first time about declaration of belief. It is true I spent a year in a seminary in the misguided thought that I could become a redemptorist priest. Now, it may be that I was one of the two or three least suited candidates for the priesthood ever to attempt that journey in Australia. And the men of the seminary, the priests, who are very fine men, really deserve a sort of spiritual equivalent of Victoria's Cross for putting up with me for a year. But it was a wonderful experience because almost all of them, they're very, very learned men. All of them were very learned men. Quite a large number of them had Roman doctorates in philosophy or theology. It was a magnificent library, absolutely magnificent library. A long time ago, in the 1970s, before kind of the madness of recent times swept away so many institutions. And institutionally, nobody could have been less suited to this life than me, except maybe my great friend Tony Abbott, who was so romantically attached to the idea of serving God as a priest that he spent 3 years in the seminary, when everyone on the planet who had ever heard of him knew for certain that he was absolutely unsuited to that life. But one of the great things about Tony is he's very stubborn, and he has a great power of will. In a way, my faith journey, I have no really good answer to this. You know, journalism is a life of thinking of good ways to express complex ideas and good answers to questions which you can anticipate. I've been asked this question a few times. I really have no good answer to it. So I grew up believing completely in Christianity. I mean, God was present in our home all the time. He was always in our conversation. It was a kind of a, you know, I mean, if you were being disparaging about it, you might say it had elements of a folk custom. But I just think it was a culture that was intact in the 1950s when I was born. And the church was our universe, you know. I went to a school that I, as an infant, that I strongly objected to because it gloried under the name of St. Thomas's Superior School for Girls. And it had boys and girls in the infants class, and it wasn't until fifth class that I got to go to the Christian Brothers. And I really wanted to go to the Christian Brothers. They used to flog me from time to time, and I thought that was good fun. When my oldest son went there, he went there in the year that they abolished corporal punishment. And I complained to the headmaster. I said, this is not going to be a Christian Brothers experience if he doesn't get the strap occasionally. And anyway, it'd be good for him. And once they got me to give the speech night prizes, and they said to me quietly, you know, Greg, we all like your jokes about that, but don't do it on the stage, okay? It's not really the image. But the brothers, I found the brothers very good guys. I was pretty happy at school. The reason that I have no answer to the question of the journey is that I accept that life is a journey and so on, but on the other hand, I have a cast of mind which is against the idea of inevitable progress or linear progress, nor do I think things are cyclical. I just think humanity is humanity, and at any moment you're in a relationship with God. When I went into journalism, when I went into mainstream secular journalism, I didn't want to be typecast as representing a particular subculture or a particular subset. So probably I made an effort, I certainly didn't ever say anything that was anti-Christian, but I made an effort not to be obviously, you know, the sort of anti-communist Catholic from central casting. And I really never mentioned the seminary. I wasn't remotely ashamed of it. As I say, the priest who was the director is still a dear friend. He's very old now. But I just didn't want that to be a central part of my identity. I wanted to succeed or fail as a secular journalist. When I wrote that book and wrote about the year in the seminary, people were sort of quite astonished. But I'd say, the Bible does tell us that we're meant to grow in wisdom, age and grace. And certainly I've grown in age. Whether I've grown in the other matters, I don't know. But and it may be that intellectually I'm not that clever, but belief itself has never been a real problem to me. Behaviour has been an enormous problem. I mean, living up to the belief, that's very, very challenging. But I can't ever really say that I ever... So one good thing from the seminary, I think, was that mixing with these brilliant men and then reading George Orwell and G.K. Chesterton and so on meant that I tried to judge things from first principles. And a lot of the stuff in our culture today is such ephemeral junk that it doesn't really attack first principles. It doesn't really relate to first principles. And then, of course, the men in the seminary were so much more clever than the men I met anywhere else that I never really felt seduced intellectually by the claims of secular culture. And then coming out was what I described in the speech, really. Just I thought it was pretty cowardly not to say something about it. And of course there is the Irish temperament. We enjoy a fight, basically. And you know, when things were going well for the church, you could just say, well, good o. Every now and again, I'll put up my hand and say, "Good on you, fellas." And but when things are going badly, you know, I went to a football match in Ireland once, County Offaly, and the football team's slogan was "The faithful never die." And as someone who barracks, I know this is very heretical in this room, the Canterbury Bulldogs NRL side, "The faithful never die" is the right approach to take to football and to faith.
Okay, thank you. So I got that sense of, you know, the faithful never die and sticking up for things, because when you were describing the new atheists and your response to them, there was this sort of visceral, "This is crap and I'm going to flatten it," in what you were saying. And I understand that, because I have that feeling sometimes as well. Was there anything happening in your life besides that that led you... I completely understand that reaction, so that the team's going, "Well, I don't need to do too much and I'm busy with the rest of my life. Now perhaps I'm not so busy with all those other things in the rest of my life, including family and so on. I've got a bit more time. God might be leading me in the roundabout way we all go through life, back towards more appreciation of this, and the team's not going so well now." Was that it, or was there other things going on as well, do you think?
No, I wish... Look, I mean, I really ought to sit down with my wife and try to work out a proper good answer to this. But the answer really is no, there wasn't. You know, I'm incredibly fortunate in my life. I live in the happiest country in the world. I do work that I love. I've got a wonderful family, you know. I mean, I can't pretend that... So the Bulldogs have had a very lean 10 years, but I can't really say...
Carlton.
Yeah, I can't really say that this brought me to the brink of tragedy, you know. You're right to see that combative tone in the chapter about belief, but you should have read it before I toned it down. I had some good friends read through chapters in advance, and one of them said to me... So at some point I commented about people in the Old Testament, and I said they weren't virtue signalling for a future ABC panel show, you know. They were, and my friend wrote to me, "Do you really want to make this a culture wars book with terms like..." And I said, "No, I don't. You're absolutely right. I don't want to adopt that tone of voice." And the first iteration of the chapter about belief started with a rebuttal of the new atheists. And then I realised that's absolutely the wrong way. Start with the positive case for belief and then deal incidentally with the new atheists at the end. There are a lot of good Christian books rebutting the new atheists, and I've read a lot of them. Very, very good books. I don't think they get read very widely. I think they're read by already believing Christians who want to know, who want the ammunition to be able to deal with. And that's a very good thing. That's an absolutely good thing. There's a real fabulous purpose to those books. I was trying to write a chapter which would appeal to people who had an interest in the subject, whether they came from an atheist point of view, a Christian point of view, or some other religious point of view. The reception of the book has been really infinitely happier than I would have ever imagined. And the best interview that I did for the book was with a conscientious atheist on ABC Radio in Sydney, Richard Glover, who really... I had to write and complain to him afterwards, because I said, "Look, buddy, it's a bit crook when the questions are so much more thoughtful and interesting than the answers, you know." And he was very wonderfully good-natured and funny about it all. He said he'd been reading the book in bed, and his wife... He said, "I nearly got him on page 58 or something when I talked about the improbability of human life, the statistical improbability." And his wife was a bit worried he was going to convert and become a believer and so on. We had a fantastic half-hour discussion, such an interesting conversation that he led me through. And then he was attacked by a certain segment of his listeners who said, "Why are you giving this Christian the chance to spruik his beliefs?" And Richard's response the next day... I mean, I don't know if he'll ever hear this podcast, I don't want to embarrass him, but it was magnificent. He went on air and scolded his listeners. He said, "Look, what a bunch of narrow-minded bigots you people are." As if anyone could accuse the ABC of running a pro-Christianity propaganda line. How ridiculous is that? Can't you have a discussion about one book for half an hour without, you know, reaching immediately for your truncheons and your scimitars and your guns and so forth? And overall, I've been... So coming out... just finish on this thought. Coming out has been much less troublesome than I thought. And in fact, when you just say straightforwardly, okay, well, this is what I believe and who I am, mostly that's fine. And sometimes people say to me, do you get any blowback within the ranks of professional journalists? And I must say I don't. We journalists are very forgiving of each other. We're incredibly judgmental of everybody else, but we're very forgiving of each other. And not only that, in any normal newsroom, not my own in Melbourne, of course, which is comprised entirely of peerless, good people, but in any normal newsroom, the range of human behaviour is so wide that merely going to church on a Sunday is a bagatelle.
Unremarkable.
Thank you. Just following on from that, because that's a really good theme, I wanted to ask you a bit about, well, not so much blowback, but whether you, is it scary or has it been in any way difficult to be more public in your Christianity and to be more bold? Because, I mean, that's one of the things you counsel Christians to be in the last chapter of your book, is to think of ourselves as a minority in this culture, which we are, and to be bold as a minority in this culture. There's two things about that. One, more than two, but one is that scary? Am I going to get rejected? I think that's probably a thought that we all have at some point, isn't it? What's it going to cost me? So could I ask you about that? Has it cost you anything? Have you experienced that? And then the second question is, which you started to touch on, what's the best way to present yourself as a Christian? You started to say that. Can you say a bit more about that as well? Or the way that you found most helpful for people to listen to you?
Well, I'm a naturally very combative person, so I had to impose discipline on myself not to be combative. And, I've done a lot of television over many years, and many, many years ago, Alexander Downer gave me some very good advice. He said, look, if you have an encounter in which you are obviously angry, the only thing that people will remember is your anger. They won't remember anything about what you said. So while I am naturally paranoid, nasty, spiteful, vicious, full of malice, I have to pretend to be a kind of kumbaya gentle soul. And and look, pretending to virtue is not a bad thing. Benjamin Franklin had a very nice insight once. He said, I cannot be humble. I'm too clever. But, but he said, I can fake humility. And faking humility is almost as good. You get a lot of the same benefits. You get to listen to other people's points of view. You don't offend people and so forth. So trying to present as a nicer person than you really are is almost a step towards becoming a nicer person than you really are. So I had less fear, in a sense, really, of being attacked than I had a fear that I would attack whenever I was contradicted. But having said that, nobody really likes to be attacked. You like to be attacked by... There are certain categories of people. It's fun to be attacked by them. But generally speaking, most people don't. And this is a difficult thing for Christians who don't spend their life in the public eye, I think. When you're used to public controversy, you accept the fact that you're going to get beaten up and you're going to throw a few punches, and that's okay. What does it matter? If they don't come round to your house and shoot you, who cares? That's not a way that normal people react. You know, normal people get criticised on a radio station or in the press or something. It's very distressing. My advice to them is don't buy the paper that day. Well, don't, and especially don't turn on social media. I know we have to contest social media, but I myself don't do any social media. And apparently there's a whole stream of people who impersonate me on social media, God bless them. I mean, what a weird thing to do, you know. Imagine having so little to fill your time with that you'd do that. But some of them are very funny, some of them are very nasty, some of them kind of agree with me and just want to get my views. My sons get upset if they see it. I have a sublime attitude to it. I just never, ever look at it one way or the other. I think at an individual level, you do whatever you're comfortable with, but the thing is just to be straightforward and true. If you're telling the truth, you can't get into much trouble. And your big problem is that people will see a gap between what you say and what you do. That's a big problem, and no human being has a proper solution to that. But in terms of the Christian movements being a bold minority, we do need to be a bold minority because we're not asking for special rights for ourselves. We're asking for special rights for the truth. And it's very important that the truth be told in our society. Societies are shaped by bold minorities. Psychologically, adjusting from a mentality where you think you represent the consensus to one where you realise that you're a minority is very important, because you're much better equipped if your psychological state conforms with reality. I spend a lot of time with soldiers, and they'll talk about situational awareness. The general who has the best situational awareness generally wins. And also, if you understand you're in the minority, you're not as distressed when you get attacked, and you don't think every attack is out of order, that people are breaking down a consensus, when in reality that consensus has been gone for a long time. But therefore you have a special duty to boldly assert the truth, which maybe a generation ago or two generations ago was widely assumed the truth, even if it wasn't widely lived up to. So I think it's invigorating to be in a minority. It's more fun, metaphorically, to be the guerrilla force throwing the bombs and finding the gunpowder than to be the conservative force defending towns and roads and so forth. I must say, those military metaphors do not go down well with any Christians at all, but I remain addicted to them.
Thank you, Greg. So, summing that up, being bold but restraining too much of our combativeness, being humble, or at least faking that as best we can, and being honest about the gap that will be obvious between the standards we profess to aspire to and what we actually live as. And that is being a bit honest and real. Is that the three parts of your advice?
That's a very sound summary.
Okay. Yeah. Can I just ask you about the your profession of journalism? I think some Christians and religious people, rightly or wrongly, perceive the media as being, at the very least, sceptical, and many journalists and media outlets being largely hostile to Christianity in particular, but maybe religion in general. Is that true, do you think? And what are the, if it is true, or if it's not true, what are the reasons for it? How do you see that?
I think that is broadly true, although journalism is full of ex-priests and ex-seminarians. Nobody graduates from journalism into holy orders, but a lot of people decline from holy orders into journalism. So Paul Bongiorno, you know, was a Catholic priest working in parishes before he left the priesthood and became a journalist. Chris Yuleman, the Channel 9, very famous Channel 9 journalist, was 3 years in a Marist seminary. Tony Abbott was a journalist before he became a politician. On my suggestion, the Bulletin hired him, and he was 3 years in a seminary. But notwithstanding that, the media class is more secular and more atheist than the general population, whereas I think the population class is more religious than the general population. Why has the media gone that way? The media, by its nature, tends to reflect the zeitgeist, I think. A lot of journalists have done very shabby arts degrees. It's almost an oxymoron. It's almost a redundancy, really. What arts degree is not shabby these days? The academy has become hostile to Western civilization. So, and of course, journalism degrees are unspeakably dreadful. My advice to any aspiring journalist is don't go anywhere near a journalism degree. And they come out with a sort of a critique of Western society, which involves a critique of Christianity. So everything bad in Western history is attributable directly to Christianity, and there is nothing good in Western history. So I have a chapter in the book that deals with the debt that Western liberalism and modern notions like human rights and democracy owe to Christianity. But people leave these university courses with the opposite view. But having said all that, that's not really a satisfactory explanation. It's a bit of a mystery. I don't know why. A lot of journalists who don't get involved in values issues in their public life are privately Christians. But the public tone, I think most countries, you know, the ABC is very good to me, so I've got no personal complaints about it. But countries which have public broadcasters like the BBC and the ABC, they seem to adopt this sort of sub-academic tone of routine condemnation of everything in Western history, and Christianity is condemned almost by association, that the only thing Christianity did was colonialism and racism and sexism and so forth. But for all of that, I have no neat answer to that question.
I'm going to ask one more question and we'll throw it open to the floor. Is that all right, Phil? That's where we're going with the timing? So my question is in two parts. You must have interviewed thousands of people and you must have met thousands of interesting people. Who was the most interesting person you've met and why? And who was the most inspiring person you met and why?
Well, I have to tell you that in the course of my journalistic life, I met my beloved wife in Kuala Lumpur, and she was certainly the most interesting person I met. I did have to become... journalism teaches you to be kind of pretty much shameless and unembarrassable and very persistent. And all these qualities were necessary in my courtship of my wife. I had to become a kind of international stalker, you know. She changed jobs. She did all kinds of things to try to get away from me, but it didn't work. And in the end, she accepted that resistance was futile and she just had to... the semi-serious answer is I was in Malaysia to interview Dr. Mahathir, who has recently come back as Prime Minister now at the great age of 93. He was an extraordinarily clever, interesting, mischievous, wicked fellow. And the fact that he's come back at age 93 inspires my beloved wife whenever we run into John Howard to say, well, you're only 80, you know. I mean, long time ahead for you in active politics. And who was the most inspiring person I ever met? I've interviewed really wonderful people, not least for this book. But there's a guy, some of you might have heard of him, but probably not, named Rich Armitage, who was the Deputy Secretary of State under George W. Bush. And he fought in Vietnam. He was a Navy counterinsurgency officer. And at the end of the Vietnam War, he was given the job to go back and evacuate the South Vietnamese Navy so the North Vietnamese couldn't get hold of it. And he redefined the South Vietnamese Navy to mean anything that would float. And he redefined Navy personnel as meaning anyone who could get on board. So he basically sailed 25 or 30,000 people down to the Philippines and they escaped the shocking, brutal, harsh, terrible treatment that communism had in store for them. And they were really the first of the Vietnamese boat people. He had no permission to do this. And he's a great, fabulous, barrel-chested, raspy-voiced, bald guy. And I said, well, Rich, weren't you a bit worried? And he said, hell no. Forgiveness is always easier to get than permission. And and of course, he could rely on the good decency of America to take those people, that they weren't going to ditch them because they're allies. Then when he came back to America, he was going to adopt a Vietnamese war orphan. And at the last moment, a relative of hers appeared. And so she was adopted by the relative. And he and his wife had their hearts set on this, and someone came and saw them and said, you know, there's a lot of American kids need that kind of help. So he and his wife fostered 50-odd kids and adopted outright 8 of them. A lot of them had congenital conditions. A lot of them had congenital drug addictions. And Rich is the most cheerful, pro-life kind of guy you could ever meet. And he's become a great friend of Jace's and mine over the years. And certainly it was a privilege to know Rich, although somehow or other in interviewing him, he recruited me to his worldwide army of people. And only Manisha, my granddaughter, has a greater ability to tell me to do something and to actually get the result, you know. So he was certainly... he doesn't figure really in any of my books, or he figures in a book about... Asian values that I wrote 20 years ago. But, I might write about Rich more fully. He has been written about in American books, but he's certainly an incredible personality. And what fun journalism is, that you get to anyone you find interesting in the society or the world, you can knock on their door plausibly and say, I'd like to interview you about your life. And 9 times out of 10, they'll say yes, because the human desire to confess is overwhelming. My great friend and colleague Paul Kelly used to say, political journalism is a job done at night, because politicians get drunk and they want to confess. And I wouldn't know that myself, but that was Paul's reflection.
Thank you, Greg.
So let's just pray for a moment or so. Father God, we thank you for the gifts and you've given, you've blessed both Greg and Mark with. And we pray for Greg as he continues on in his professional career and his home life. Pray that when he has engagement in the media, when he's on television, when he's been interviewed, when he has personal interactions with senior people or people who make decisions, that you might give him great wisdom and insight, and that he might speak the truth and really, really impact people for you in every situation. Pray for Mark also as he continues his work in his think tank where they're lobbying politicians for promoting the Judeo-Christian ethic in completely secular language. You might give his organisation great impact, that might really make real change in some of the policies that are happening and change policies so that they're more aligned to your will. And bless both these guys. May they also have personal quiet times that are inspired, where they know your spirit sitting with them and touching them, so they might follow you more closely, and give them good refreshing times at home as well with their families. In Jesus' name, amen.